last time, the primary thing we did was look at Deuteronomy's attempt to strip down the monarchy to essentially make for a monarch with none of the perks of monarchy. And then we saw that the book of Samuel can be read, or in the section in the book of Samuel that we read can be interpreted as nice try, Deuteronomy, but having a king only and inevitably leads to one place, which is this kind of tyrannical picture that is portrayed. And in addition, we saw the way that the last days of Solomon function in the Bible as a kind of paradigm for monarchy gone amok, for what happens when monarchic power is unfettered, uncontrolled, and therefore, you know, without any limits. What I wanted to do tonight is essentially part two of this unit one. And I wanted to begin by drawing your attention to a passage that may be familiar to some or many of you, but I think is worth looking at, a very unique and interesting and provocative and controversial, as we'll see, passage from Sefer Shoftim, the book of Judges. The book of Judges describes 40 years of peace under Gidon, who then dies. Once Gidon dies, the people turn astray and follow a foreign god. In the language of the book itself, they forget God and are disloyal to Gidon and his legacy. Then, in the way of, you know, royal families and their intrigue, Avimelech, who is the son of one of Gidon's concubines, murders his 70 brothers so that he can rule exclusively. Only one brother escapes, and that is Gidon's youngest son, Yotam, who, upon being told about what Avimelech has done, publicly offers up a scathing parable about his brother Avimelech. The book of Judges, chapter 9, verse 7, for those of you looking in a Tanakh, Vayagidu leYotam, and they told Yotam what had happened, Vayelech vayamod berosh har Grizim, he went and stood on the Mount of Grizim, Vayisa kolo vayikra, and he raised his voice and said, Vayomer lahem, and he said, Shim'u elai ba'alei Shechem, listen to me, you important of Shechem, and you will be heard. Now, I just briefly want to mention here that Har Grizim, the people of Shechem could not actually hear anything that was being recited on Har Grizim. The point, I think, is either a kind of literary model of someone speaking from a high place when they want authority. Think of what we read just a little while ago in Shul of Balak taking Bilam to a high place, or Yotam, knowing that his life is in danger, is described as offering up this scathing critique from a safe distance, right? Those are two possibilities of what's going on here. This is really just because I can't read a text like this without paying attention to some of the literary stuff that's going on. That's not particularly pertinent to our democracy question, but I think it's actually kind of striking. And here's the parable that he offers. The trees went to appoint over themselves, to really to anoint over themselves a king. And they said to the olive tree, rule over us. And the olive tree responded by saying, Vayomer lahem hazayit, hechadalti et dishni asher bi chabdu Elohim va'anashim, Bahalachti lanua al ha'itzim? Has all my good stuff dissipated through which God and men are honored, whatever that means exactly? I guess you could also say for which God and men honor me, but I think through whom God and men are honored is better. Lanua al ha'itzim, to wave above the trees, JPS says. I think slightly more elegant, Richard Nelson's translation, to sway over the trees, meaning to rule over them. Meaning, I think, we're already supposed to see, the olive says, I actually do something good for the world. You want me to give that up to be a king? Right? I mean, I think that that's the meaning on some level of the olive's answer. What, I should give up the good stuff in order to be I'm going to say, useless. So now what do they, they don't respond, but rather they say, Vayomru ha'itzim la'teina. So the trees said to the fig tree, L'chi at molchi aleinu. Now note they insert the emphatic pronoun. You come rule over us. There is a greater sense of urgency now, right? The olive tree has turned us down. You, fig tree, you rule over us. And of course, the fig tree says no. Batomer lahem hateina, hechadalti et motki, ve'et tnuvati hatova, v'halachti lanua la'etzim. Have I also run out of useful things to do that I should be a king over you? And so they move on to the vine. Vayomru ha'itzim la'gefen. And now the emphatic again. L'chi at molchi aleinu. So they went to the vine and they said, you rule over us. You should maybe get here a sense of desperation, because we have now moved from trees to quasi-trees. A vine is not even really a tree. And in any case, it is too low to sway over any other trees, right? So there's a kind of absurdity to this parable. An absurdity, just to be clear, that the narrator, I think, has in mind. Vatomer lahem hagefen, hechadalti atiroshim, sameach Elohim va'anashim, v'halachti lanua al ha'etzim. Have I run out of wine, which gladdens both gods and men, that I should go and sway over the trees? Now, by the way, this is also not our topic, but I find the language here of Mesameach Elohim va'anashim really interesting, whether Elohim here should be translated as God or gods. I mean, this may be some kind of mythical reference to gods who consume wine. Not sure, okay? So now what do they do? We're getting to the punchline here. Vayomru chol ha'itzim el ha'atad. They all go to the thorn bush. A barren shrub whose fruit cannot be eaten, right? Has nothing to offer. Lech ata miloch aleinu. How about you? You rule over us. Vayomer ha'atad el ha'itzim, and the thorn bush responded to the trees, Im be'emet atem moshchim oti lemelech aleichem, bo'u chasu b'tzili. Now this is actually kind of hilarious. If you are in honesty wanting to be for me to be the king, come rest in my shade. Now, my suggestion to you is, on a day like today, try to rest in the shade of a thorn bush and see what is accomplished. The answer will be very little, okay? V'im ayin, but if you are somehow asking me in a way that is disingenuous, teitzei esh min ha'atad v'tochalat arzei halvanon. Then let fire come out from this thorn bush and consume the trees of Lebanon. Now, in this last scene, Kol Ha'itzim, verse 14, all of the trees come, which makes the request even more emphatic. There's a sense of desperation. We really want to have a king, and we're running out of options. And then, as I mentioned, this kind of ironic or even satiric view of the thorn bush, as if it can really provide shade. But crucially here already, I think you can see that the parable works to undercut Avimelech, a low character who can provide no shade. And arguably, although we're going to come to this controversy in a few minutes, arguably an argument against kingship as an institution, that is, only a lowlife thorn bush like Avimelech would actually even want this job. You know who wants to be a king? Someone who's fill in your blank here, a narcissist with no limits, no boundaries, no sense of any sense of what's appropriate, what's acceptable, no sense of norms. Sorry, I got a little carried away. And the irony is deeper here because this thorn bush, this bramble, its only real value is in providing kindling for fire. So Avimelech, the thorn bush, and the people of Shechem, namely the trees, right? They form a covenant which will yield minimal, if any, blessing at all. That is, the little bit of shade that a bramble bush can provide, and provides abundant curse, a forest fire started with the kindling of a bramble. I am belaboring this a little bit because I want you to see that this kind of almost playful parable is actually trying to make a significant point, which is if you make a person like Avimelech king, not only will it not lead you to the blessing you hope that having a king will bring to you, but rather it will wreak utter havoc and devastation. The use of the term cedars of Lebanon is important here because it's a warning, right? That if the trees attempt to rebel, the thorn bush's fire will consume even the highest and most mighty. Nothing will save from the destruction. I mean, if you think about this, and I don't want to be political, and I don't, but like the notion that a less than savory character who rules can wreak massive devastation such that even the highest of the high are destroyed by its fire is not like such a crazy idea to contemplate, right? And I think that there's something here very, very powerful that this text wants to make. And it's also worth noting here, I think, and I don't know if this is sarcastic exactly, but right, if X, then Y, and if not X, then Z, is the language of covenantal curse and blessing. So it's sort of like placed in the mouth of this lowly thorn bush is the warning of utter devastation can come from this. Sorry, you know what? I should also say that this seems to be an example that we have not so infrequently in Tanakh of a pattern, what scholars talk about is a pattern of three and four, where you have a list of four things and the fourth element is different and that difference is climactic in some way. So we have three refusals to be king by trees that actually are useful, and then the agreement of one tree who's totally useless to take on this task. And that structure is a way of underscoring that somehow the refusal of the first three leads to the stepping in of the monstrous, useless thornbush. Okay? One of the things that you may be noticing if you're kind of able to zoom out for a minute is that the parable only fits the story of Avimelech very inexactly. And that could either mean that the Bible is not necessarily so concerned with a parable being exactly fitting, see the end of the book of Jonah, for example, for a parable that doesn't really work, right? Or that this was once a freestanding parable that is pulled into this story to make a point. Now, what comes next, many academics see this as a later insertion. I'm not that interested in this question, to be perfectly honest. But so in verse 15, he gives you the nimshal. If you really appointed Avimelech and that process came with integrity, and if you did it by treating Yerubal, another name for Gidon, well, then this will be great. But if not, you know, all hell will break loose. That's the part that people think is potentially a later insertion where he makes explicit, if you've been faithful to my father, then okay. But if you have not been faithful to my father, which obviously you have not, then a fire will come out from Avimelech and destroy everything, including him. And that's a reference to the later battle between Gidon and the Shechemites when they fall out. I'm sorry, between Avimelech and the Shechemites when they fall out with each other. And so that's basically the story. And then Yotam finishes the story and promptly runs away. Here's an interesting question. Is this, as one might be tempted to read at first glance, another in the line that we have been developing of biblical texts that are rather savage in their critique of the monarchy? Or is this intended more locally as a critique of this particular king brought to kingship under this particular circumstance. And as I hinted before, scholars are kind of divided on this point. Source 12 is a contemporary Bible scholar named Robert Gnussa, who writes this kind of polemic, this book about how the Bible is like a kind of, among other things, an extended polemic against monarchy. And he says the following: "This parable can stand on its own with meaning apart from the narrative in which it is found," which, by the way, I'm now adding, would be correct, especially if what I hinted at earlier is true, which is that this might have been an independent parable that is, you know, brought in here for this point. He says, "You do not need to know the references to the aspirations of Avimelech to be king and how he killed all his brothers and half-brothers, save Yotam, the one who crafted the fable. The critique of kingship is clear simply within the parable itself. The power of the critique is carried by the humor of the story. The olive tree, fig tree, and vine all see their everyday function as more important than being king over the trees. What does this say about kingship in general? These plants view the institution as rather worthless. Only the pathetic bramble is willing to be king, and he is worthless. Perhaps only worthless individuals become kings," the parable implies. "The pomposity of the bramble entertains. Take refuge in my shadow," says the bramble. "How paltry is the shadow," etc. Okay? And then he ends the last sentence: "This is true sarcasm of kings and the pompous pride with which they comport themselves." Dennis Olson, a very, very fine Bible scholar, commentary on the book of Judges, I just wanted you to see this contrast. Here's what Dennis Olson says: "The story of Avimelech is sometimes interpreted as a general indictment of any form of kingship or centralized government within Israel. However, Judges 9 and its fable indict a specific form of kingship, characterized by gaining power through brute force and violence. In the final analysis, the book of Judges will support certain forms of kingship and centralized authority. The positive attributes of such a model," he will then lay out what he thinks is necessary. He wants to argue, don't overread this parable. It's not actually about kingship. It's about this one scoundrel who becomes king. I want to try, if I can, to explain what I think is behind Olson's interpretation. I'm not sure I'm right about it, but I think is behind it. And then suggest why, at the end of the day, I'm not sure he's right. You know, I suspect that Olson is, and you can sort of see this in his words, is perplexed by the fact that most scholars, not all, but most scholars think that the central thrust of the Book of Judges is thoroughly pro-monarchic. The book begins and ends by saying there was no king in Israel in those days, and people did whatever that they pleased, and the society had run amok. And it seems like, again, this is the, I think, the majority view. I would even say it's a large majority view, but it's not universal. The majority view is that the Book of Judges is actually making a case for the need for a monarch. I suspect that Dennis Olson is trying to fit this parable into that larger interpretation of the Book of Judges, whereby the Book of Judges is not anti-monarchic, but on the contrary. I have to say, I don't think the parable on its own terms is necessarily about taking kingship through violence and intrigue. It seems to me about how no tree that actually has something to contribute would ever want to be a king. And if I'm right in suggesting that perhaps this parable used to exist independent of the story in which we now find it, then it's all the more possible that it is a fundamentally anti-monarchic text. I just want to make sure people understand what I'm talking about, that I'm not, you know, on Mars here. In other words, if you just read the parable, there's nothing at all about how the bramble took over by, you know, murdering the other trees or anything like that. It's just that no tree worth its salt would ever want to be a king. That seems to me to be, at minimum, a rather scathing assessment of the character of the kind of person who wants to be a king. So I would be inclined to read this as part of this larger chain that we've seen of the anti-monarchic thrust of biblical texts, even though, as I mentioned, that is not the only voice in the Bible. The Bible also revels at various points, for example, in David and his family, and yet exposes him to brutal critique at the same time as well. So, right, it's all very, I mean, you know, one of the things I was thinking about today, I was a little hesitant about teaching this class, is that you can literally just spend your time cutting out the legs of every sentence you just said when it comes to the monarchy in the Bible. It's just very, very complex. But my inclination, at least for the moment, and I am open to being corrected and critiqued on this point, truly, is that this text, I think Nusa is more correct than Olson on this point, and that we can see this as part of a larger preoccupation with, you know, it almost adds to the story we've seen. We saw that kingship inevitably leads to tyranny, in the words of Samuel. Maybe this parable explains why that is, because what kind of person would want to be a monarch in the first place? It's a person who's already given to tyrannical impulses.
There's a question about, in the text from Ben Goldberg, could lanua mean to wave? The idea being that a king has a high position and attracts a lot of attention, but doesn't actually do anything useful.
I mean, if you mean to wave in the sense of, you know, the queen waving, then probably not. That's not what lanua means. But is that a wave like a flag? Yeah. I mean, I think that is what it means on some level. It's like to somehow symbolically assert one's greater authority over something like that. I think so. Yeah. Now, whether that specific image is supposed to suggest not actually doing anything, not sure. Certainly possible. Certainly possible.
How does this parable tie into a burning bush playing such a central role in the life of our people?
That's a fun question. So I think, actually, quite well, if you take seriously the rabbinic idea that one of the reasons that God appears in a bush is that God wants to appear in a lowly place as a statement of God's humility, then actually the bramble is playing the same kind of role in both stories. In both cases, it's a nothing. It's just in one case, the people are foolish enough to make the nothing king. And in the second case, the point is that God is so humble that God is willing to appear even in a bramble, which is in fact relatively useless. So I don't think they're contradictory at all. I think they're actually an interesting pairing.
You mentioned, from Jerry Golden, you mentioned others don't accept kingship, ? And then from Gloria Beeler, can God allow good leadership?
I mentioned others oppose kingship. I don't know what that's a reference to, so I would need to hear more about what that question is. Can God allow good leadership? I think, look, from the perspective of these stories, I think actually God is desperate for good leadership. The problem is that the people constantly want setups that lead to exploitation. I mean, you think, for example, about Psalm 72. I mean, most people don't think, for example, about Psalm 72, but think about Psalm 72, for example. That is a psalm about how the Solomonic king is supposed to conduct himself. And the picture there is of a God who's looking for a king who will side with and plead the cause of the poorest and most vulnerable members of society. God would love to have that kind of king according to that psalm. But the point is, as Ezekiel 34 makes clear, that's not how kings actually function. Right? That's not how kings function. So I think the challenge is, it's like God wants good leadership and people don't. I mean, in the case of what we saw in Samuel, people want a military leader. And maybe it's understandable, right? You don't always have to, I mean, I hope this is not too heretical for anyone here, but you don't have to always just assume that the Bible's polemic against another position means that the other position has no value at all. Right? So maybe it's the case. It's understandable that the people wanted a king. But the Bible's point is, okay, it's still massively destructive. I think, Gloria, at the risk of being not relevant to the present day, right, what we might say in response to this is, God not only would allow good leadership, but would want good leadership, but significant chunks of the Bible seem to think that a king inevitably will not be that. And that's how this is relevant to our question of democracy, is that you're not going to get that from a king. Psalm 72 can dream that a king will be like that, and texts like Ezekiel 34, in which God fires the kings, show that that's not actually what happens. So I want to ask you to turn to a text that some of you have studied with me in various settings. I'm not going to, you know, say an awful lot about this, but I do want to point to the wild subversiveness when it comes to monarchy of this text. And that text is Genesis 1:26-28, the creation of the human being in the image of God. Here I'm going to make the case for biblical scholarship as a Torah value. This is a case where I think you cannot understand what Genesis 1 is doing if you do not know anything about the ancient Near Eastern context. I would say that here, the pshat of Genesis 1 is unavailable to you without the ancient Near Eastern context. What do I mean by that? In the ancient Near East, really all over the ancient Near East, kings were seen as images of the gods of the societies that they ruled over. The king of Babylon is an image of the god Babylon worships. And what it means to be an image of a god, in part, is to be appointed by God from creation to rule over the rest of God's creations. So the king of Babylon is destined by God from creation to rule over the people of Babylon. This is as close as you come to a theology of the divine right of kings in the ancient world. That's what an image of God is. That's what a tselem of an Elohim is. It is only when you realize that, that you can kind of be brought breathless by what Genesis 1 does, which is to say, wait a minute, an image of God is a king, and a king is an image of God. You know who's royalty? Every last human being on the face of the earth without exception. We are all kings and queens. Every human on the face of the earth is royalty. It's not just the king of Babylon, it's every last citizen of Babylon. It's not just the ruler, it's everyone. And what that means politically, the political theology of Genesis 1, is that no human being is destined from the creation to rule over any other human being. There is no such thing as a divine right of kings. There is, if anything, this, I would say, almost egalitarian thrust to this passage. That is a remarkable assault on monarchy. And it is not an assault on monarchy based on the corruption of monarchy in the way that Deuteronomy is anxious about and Samuel is confident about. It is an assault on monarchy for theological and metaphysical reasons, which is, it is based on a lie. It is based on a misapprehension of what it means for God to have created all of us. In other words, it is a deeper critique. It's not that monarchy is corrupt. I mean, which it is. It's that monarchy is based on a fiction that is a toxic fiction. At that. I mean, this is, I almost can't overstate how wildly subversive this really is. By the way, I won't get into this now, but I think there's another piece of this that is also really, really important, which is in the ancient Near East, and this goes back to something I was saying in response to Gloria about Psalm 72. In the ancient Near East, it is the king who is made responsible for the well-being of widows and orphans. In the Bible, it is every Israelite citizen, because we're all kings. You can't say, my government is doing this, it's not my responsibility. It is your responsibility. You are a citizen of Israel, you are a king. So in other words, the dignity and status that comes with Tzelem Elohim also is accompanied by, kind of inextricably with, inextricably bound up with moral responsibility. Now, I want to say this one other way that might be helpful. So recall what I said about how in the ancient world, the king who is created in the image of God, in the image of the God, is destined to rule over the rest of the inhabitants of the city. I think what Genesis 1 does is try to take the category of the image of God as ruler and move it away from the political altogether and put it instead in terms of humanity as a whole's relationship to the rest of creation. It is not that the king is meant to rule over you and me. It is that you and I and all of us are intended to rule over the rest of creation. And that, of course, raises the question that we could talk about at great length that I've taught on many times over the years, which we won't talk about now here. What does it mean for us to be appointed to rule over the rest of the creation? And how do we think about that in an age of environmental degradation and crisis? There's a lot to say there. But in other words, I'm struggling for a way to say this, but the point that I'm making is what the Bible effectively does is take the notion of king as ruler and depoliticize it, move it outside the realm of the political to the realm of the, and I don't know what the next word is, I'm groping for it, into the realm of the interspecies-al. How's that for a failing freshman English? Okay, but that's the point that I'm making that I hope is at least somewhat clear. So I think there's this really interesting and powerful move here, and this is really kind of a cutting out the legs from the very notion of monarchy, right? It's not a critique of monarchy's failures; it's a critique of monarchy, period. And that's the point I wanted to make. And by the way, what an ecological theology would say is, you know how in the Bible, kings always fail and end up corruptly abusing their subjects? Yeah, right, exactly. That's exactly how humans function as kings over the rest of creation. There's something enormously powerful there about the way it works perfectly, actually. I need to just underscore just a couple more things about Genesis 1, which are not going to be, you know, new insights for anyone here. But I want to underscore that Genesis 1 goes out of its way to say male and female God created them, right? Lest you think that this is about the equality of all men. We hold that all men are created equal. Genesis 1, in fact, is saying something more radical than that. And wants to underscore that it's saying that by saying male and female God created them. I think there's something really, you know, that text is so familiar that it's hard to hear, but it's pretty wild claim in any time, let alone in the ancient world. And also, although this is not going to be the main thing I talk about, also there is this really interesting thing, which is, in the ancient world, cultures told creation stories that culminated in the creation of the culture telling the story. So the Babylonian creation story culminates in the creation of Babylonia. Genesis 1 is totally outside the flow of the world that it inhabits in that way, in that ancient Israel tells a story of creation in which ancient Israel is not primordial in any way. That is to say, it begins with Adam, not Abraham. That is a profoundly universalizing move. John Levinson refers to that, I think, quite wonderfully as the universal horizon of biblical particularism. Right? The Bible will go on to celebrate particularity, but it will not do that before first establishing a radical claim for shared humanity and universality. The next step I'd like to take is to say something about covenant and equality. And here, I really want to summarize and then offer a little bit of a criticism of really, I think, path-breaking scholarship from Josh Berman at Bar-Ilan University, whose work some of you may be familiar with. I want to just sort of lay this out because I think it is a next step in many ways in the Bible's grappling with this question. The covenant, as many of you know, is modeled on ancient Near Eastern suzerainty treaties in which a sovereign power holds supremacy over another state, which has its own ruler, but which is not allowed to act as an independent power. So, you know, let's say Judith Cates is like an emperor, and I am just like a lowly king, and I enter into a suzerainty treaty with Judith in which she holds supreme power over me. I am a king of a state, but I can't really do anything without Judith's permission. And I have to, in various ways, show her deference. Now, as a rule, suzerainty treaties were enacted between kings, not between peoples. I'm a lowly king. Judith is a big emperor. You would think, right, in the ancient world, we would establish a suzerainty treaty, not Judith's people and my people, me and Judith. But in the Torah, God is the supreme sovereign, but who is the vassal? The Israelites do have a leader, obviously. We call him later on Moshe Rabbeinu, but he is not referred to as a king. And nothing in the narrative suggests that Moses is God's vassal king. Rather, right, God seems to be forming a treaty with the people. The king, who you would expect to be God's vassal, is ignored in Deuteronomy so that the covenant treaty can be made with the people. It is not, okay? It's not that God is entering a suzerainty treaty with the collective body of the Israelite people, but rather the subordinate king with whom God forms a political treaty is the common person, or better, I think, we'll come to this, the common man. The implication of that, now I'm going to quote Berman, is that, quote, every man in Israel is to view himself as having the status of a king conferred upon him. Biblically speaking, in other words, we might say that God is the king, capital K, but all Israelite men are kings, small k. Now, if this has got your kind of feminist protest urge up, good, it should. We're going to get there. I'm on my way, okay? Now, notice that what happens here, right, is that any human king of Israel is effectively demoted, stripped of metaphysical or theological status. He is not in some kind of unique person-to-person vassal treaty with God, but rather all the men are. The covenant that is at the heart of the Torah's vision was formed between God and the people, and the king is deliberately and rather, I think, dramatically left out of the picture. And Berman's argument is that this is extremely deliberate, the consequence, he argues, of a deep-seated commitment to equality. I'll quote Berman for a moment here. Only through the sublimation of the metaphysical standing of the monarchy in Israel could the biblical text achieve a reformulation of social and political thought along egalitarian lines. I'll read that one more time. Only through the sublimation of the metaphysical standing of the monarchy in Israel could the biblical text achieve a reformulation of social and political thought along egalitarian lines. In other words, the common man is not so common after all. The common man is a king, a servant king, with an overlord, to be sure, but nevertheless, a king. Here are some examples. Elsewhere in the ancient Near East, the gods spoke exclusively to kings. In the Torah, in contrast, God addresses the masses. Elsewhere in the ancient Near East, the vassal king is periodically required to come and hear the treaty stipulations read aloud to him. In Deuteronomy, in contrast, that duty is incumbent upon all Israelites, because, again, to belabor the point, we're all kings. Elsewhere in the ancient Near East, the vassal king is obligated to visit the court of the suzerain. In Israel, in contrast, every Israelite male is included in the obligation to make pilgrimage to Jerusalem. So what you have here, again, I'm coming to the gender piece in a moment, which is not small, but what you have here, I think, in Deuteronomy, and I'm not sure why Berman doesn't actually say this, which is very confusing to me. You have here Deuteronomy trying to play out in a covenantal context the logic of creation in Genesis 1. And I am not interested here in whether Genesis 1 or Deuteronomy is earlier. That is, like, you know, not what interests me here at all. But I think that's essentially what you have as a move. However, I think we ought to tread very carefully here, perhaps a little more carefully than Berman treads, because the idea that the Torah elevates the masses and the common person requires some serious nuancing, right? As Berman himself acknowledges, but very quickly moves past, the Torah lays out a blueprint that takes for granted that women are subordinated to men and are excluded from participating in many areas, including the judiciary, the cult, the military, land ownership, and quite a few other things. So impressive and even stunning as the Torah's movement towards equality is, it nevertheless maintains, or I should actually be more careful here, as impressive and stunning as Deuteronomy's movement towards equality is, Deuteronomy nevertheless maintains a very stark gender hierarchy. I would put it this way, and this is intended to be a provocative formulation. Where gender is concerned, I think we can say that the rest of the Torah is not quite as radical as Genesis 1. Deuteronomy does not play out what I at least would be inclined to see as the inherent logic of Genesis 1. It plays out the logic of Genesis 1 with men, but it does not play that logic out with people more broadly. In Deuteronomy, in other words, the king is indeed demoted, right? And the masses are indeed elevated. But the masses who are elevated are men. And not all men, by the way, but specifically heads of households. So we might be inclined to talk about an egalitarianism among heads of households in ancient Israel, rather than seeing ancient Israel, as Deuteronomy imagines it, as a kind of uniformly egalitarian, socially homogenous class. I don't think that that's accurate. I would like it to be that, but I don't think it actually is that. To use my own kind of language, the covenant between God and Israel, as Deuteronomy imagines it, is not egalitarian, but it does contain a dramatic egalitarianizing thrust. And a different topic for a different type of class would be, what are we as heirs of tradition to do when we see a thrust that is not yet complete? That's like a conversation that we could have. You know, I started an institution based on really thinking about that question as I understood it. That's a trajectory that I wanted to sort of show you over the last two sessions, which is the way I organize these texts is in a kind of increasing radicalization, right? Deuteronomy tries to strip the king. Samuel says, yeah, good luck. Parenthetically, we saw Solomon, who's the paradigm for failing, right? Then, arguably, from Judges, only the wrong kind of person would want to be a king in the first place. And then Genesis 1, as a kind of theological dismantling of the monarchy, and Deuteronomy as an incomplete playing out of the logic of the creation story in Genesis 1 in covenant.
From Jerry Golden, how does the stress on egalitarianism mesh with the special role of the Kohanim and the Levi'im?
I think what I would say about that for now, which will not satisfy you, I'm quite confident of that, is that Deuteronomy tries to do something dialectical. On the one hand, it assigns people special tasks. And on the other hand, every single time a person is assigned a special task in Deuteronomy, the key word that starts appearing over and over and over again is achicha, your brother. This kind of thrust about equality. So the king is the king over his brothers and may not have his ego lorded over his brothers. The judges in Deuteronomy 1, the Levites, the rich man over the poor man in Deuteronomy 15. So Deuteronomy seems to recognize that I'm a little hesitant about whether I completely believe what I'm about to say, but I'm going to try it out. Deuteronomy recognizes that in a society, some people need to have elevated roles, but it is extremely concerned to remind you that those roles are not metaphysically reflective of some deep ontological difference. You know what a Kohen is? A Kohen is someone with a special set of responsibilities for doing religion. You know what a king is? Well, we saw what a king is. It's a symbolic exemplar of a from Jew who's learning Torah all day. So we saw last time, right? So that's my best answer. I at the risk of being ridiculous for a minute, I think that actually is Deuteronomy's answer, meaning I think it's dialectical. It's like you need certain roles, but you ought to make sure that people don't become haughty about their roles. Judges judge their brothers, not their subjects. Kings rule over their brothers, not their subjects. And here, brothers, I should say siblings, I think. I'm not quite sure. In other words, I'm struggling here between wanting to use egalitarian language and wanting to be accurate about the text. And I'm not quite certain what the answer here is, which is why I'm hedging a little bit. So it's really striking in light of Deuteronomy and 1 Samuel, especially, that when you get to the time of the Tanaim, the people who brought us the Mishnah, right? The sages of the first couple centuries, that by the time you get to the Tanaim, it seems to be a widely held view that Israel has a positive obligation to appoint a monarch. This is a surprising development in light of the clear thrust, I think, of Deuteronomy and 1 Samuel. And if I'm not mistaken, right, the discussion of monarchy as an imperative is found in Jewish sources for the first time in the time of the Tanaim. And if you look at the first source there, you have a Rav Nehorai's attitude is basically a recapitulation of what Deuteronomy 17 says. Deuteronomy 17 does not command that you have a monarch, but only suggests that if you really want one, you can have one. And then, as we saw, a rather stripped down one at that. So, after all, Rabbi Nehorai is right in the sense that Deuteronomy 17 seems to be offering a rather disconcerting prediction or implicit prediction about what a king would be like unless we strip him. You know, since we don't have the time, I'm not looking at these sources in depth, but he even goes so far as to say the desire to have a king is a form of idolatry. And there's a lot we could say about that, which I won't say for now. And if people want me to, I'll start with that next time. And Rav Nehorai seems to be condemning the whole idea of kingship. It's not this king or that. It's the whole idea that Israel should have a king at all. And as Gerald Blitzstein, great historian of halakha, has pointed out, among sages, right, Talmudic rabbis who are opposed to monarchy, the general argument is that there is an irreducible tension between the idea of the kingdom of heaven, Malchut Shamayim, on the one hand, and the idea of having a human monarch on the other. Those two things really can't be reconciled, right? That's the famous line of Gidon that we didn't look at in the book of Judges. Not I will be king over you or my sons, but God will be king over you. But then you have to try to understand Rabbi Judah, right? Which is this bizarre statement, right? That Israel was commanded to establish a monarchy. And this is based on Deuteronomy 17:15, which we talked about last time, Som Tasim, which I suggested the pshat of which is not you must, but you surely may appoint a king. And then Rabbi Judah has a problem, which is, yeah, but how are you going to explain the book of Samuel, which condemns the Israelites? And here is something really suggestive, which may be the explanation. Can I underline the words maybe many, many times? And here also, let me swear off any credit or responsibility for this position. This is straight out of Gerald Blitzstein's work on monarchy and Jewish political thought. How does Rabbi Judah explain why the people were described as doing something wrong? Because they rushed matters. What does that mean? They rushed matters? What, they weren't supposed to have a king yet, but they were supposed to have a king eventually? Most people don't know that we have a little fragment of the Mechilta on Deuteronomy. Solomon Schechter found this. An explicit Tannaitic text saying that building the sanctuary was supposed to have come before crowning a king. So that Israel's sin in asking for a king from Samuel was in the timing of the request. When God says that they rejected me, God is not saying, according to this text, that they rejected me in wanting to have a king. It's that they rejected me in wanting to have a king before I had a temple. That is to say, in making the earthly king come before the heavenly king. Now, all of this is a way of leading to the following point, which you are free to do whatever you like with, including write off as silly. But I'm not sure it's silly, even if it might not be right. Why in the second century might a sage say, and many sages then come to agree, that there's a positive commandment to appoint a king, but that Israel's failure is that they didn't do it in the right time? Because in the second century, the sages are all wrestling with the legacy of Bar Kokhba, who wanted to be a king and didn't wait to rebel. And they made him a king before they had a temple. Some people want to suggest, and I think this is not something you can prove, this is completely speculative, that on some level, Rav Nehorai and Rav Yehuda can be seen as, at, among other things, not just at loggerheads about monarchy, but at loggerheads over Bar Kokhba in particular. That Rav Nehorai's position would be, we're not supposed to have that. And Rav Yehuda's position is, we went about it all wrong. Now, all of this is based on, we don't know how to explain what he means by saying, they rushed matters. That is a very thin strand of evidence on which to hang a theory. It nevertheless tries to reckon as best as we can with why this very strange development in the second century. Like, what's going on? And that's what's going on. Right? I mean, when you have this kind of turning over a biblical tradition on its head, it makes you wonder what's going on to push people in that direction. And that's what's going on. Now, again, I think this is totally speculative. But it kind of makes some sense. Gerald Blitzstein, who forgot more Torah than I will ever know, seemed to think it was a plausible thrust, but was also extremely cautious about saying, yeah, it requires a lot of leaps that go beyond what we have evidence for. And it requires choosing to read some core machlokot, some core debates in Tannaitic literature as rooted in a debate about a political reality that surrounded them and without any concrete evidence. I can't point to you to a text where Rav Nehorai says, I was always talking about Bar Kokhba all along. If I had that, this would be a much easier discussion. But as I mentioned last time, I've just always been puzzled by why, right? you could get this kind of seemingly anti-Deuteronomic. And yes, it appeals to Deuteronomy. I get that. But this seemingly turning Deuteronomy on its head, what would cause that? And that's the best I got for you as a very tenuous, tentative hypothesis that is not even really my own.
How can the Israelites be blamed for rushing things when God selects Gidon and Shaul and David?
Well, right. I mean, the problem is I don't know how to answer that because I have no idea what rushing things means. I mean, I think that the answer is maybe what you just said in the question, which is God selects those people. But in the case of Shmuel, it's the people who take the initiative and want a king. It's precisely where it's coming from. Maybe the issue is that the people are usurping a prerogative that belongs to God. I'm not sure. It's a really good question.
Don't the Tanaim need to reassure the Babylonian rulers that they weren't challenging their rulership?
Meaning, is it, you have a king? That's not a bad thing, because after all, we believe in kings. Or is it, you should be threatened by us because we want to have a king? I don't know which one it is. I mean, I think either of those are possible, but this is not an answer to the question, but I'm inclined to say this. You know, the three mitzvot that are traditionally described by the Tanaim that the people have to fulfill are building the temple, appointing a king, and rooting out Amalek. Rebelling against Rome might look like a way of doing all three at once, and might explain why people feel theologically motivated to do that. Okay, there was one other question at the bottom that I saw come across my screen from Eliana that I thought was really interesting. I wanted to just briefly, an ending, talk about that. And I haven't really thought about this before. To boat 111, I forget if it's 111a or 111b, famous sugya in the Talmud talks about how the Israelites took a vow not to force the end. Among the other, shelo yidchaku et haketz. And does that relate, I think this is Eliana's question, to this notion of not rushing things here? Now, I said I wanted to underline that question because I think it's really interesting. That did not mean that I have an answer to it. That passage, that there's this passage in Masechet Ketubot that lists three oaths that the Israelites took that seem to be about not rebelling against the rule of the nations and not rushing the world towards its messianic conclusion. That text has been enormously important in the history of debates between religious Zionists and religious anti-Zionists in ways that could be its own many months long seminar. There's a tremendous amount you can say about just like the afterlife of this one passage in Masechet Ketubot. One perfectly reasonable way, and perhaps even obviously right way, to read that passage in Ketubot is that it's a deeply quietistic picture, which is like, you know, you wait for God to redeem you, you don't redeem yourself. What I'm not sure is whether this they rush things is meant to be quite so sweeping as that. That one is sweeping, right? Is this sweeping or local? Well, once again, I don't know what they rush things meant. So it's hard for me. That's why it's such an interesting question. It's like, it depends on, we have to interpret the text so that we can compare it to another text, but we don't have an interpretation of the text yet. And it does it mean that they rush things by supporting Bar Kokhba? Or that they rush things, if it's about Bar Kokhba, that they rush things by supporting Bar Kokhba? Or that they rush things by supporting Bar Kokhba too dramatically, too quickly, right? Was it a failure of quietism or a failure of theological or political judgment? Those are not the same thing. It's only the same as not forcing the end if the argument that they push things is quietistic. But I don't see a reason to necessarily assume that it is. I will leave you with just because it's so interesting, when the first religious Zionists want to move to the land and they're dealing with this text that says, you're not allowed, one of the vows is shelo yalu b'choma or shelo yalu k'choma. Hard to know exactly what the right version of that is, that they not go up by force. So there are like a whole array of interpretations of why Zionism is not a violation of those oaths. And one of the most moving ones, just in terms of, forget about whether you think it's right or it's wrong. I'm not doing theology here. I'm doing history of ideas, right? One of the most moving arguments is, I mean, yeah, but that was predicated on them not abusing us, meaning the nations broke their oath. So aren't we allowed to break our own to save our lives? Whether that's a good reading of the Sugya or not is a totally different thing. It's just like a fascinating moment where the pathos of Jewish history comes out in textual interpretation.